Bob Sorrentino from Italian Roots and Genealogy, and I have the perfect guest today for this Columbus Day week, and yes, it is Columbus Day, Joe Arazi, the author of Little America. So welcome, Joe. Thanks for being here.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
No, my pleasure. My pleasure. So certainly want to talk about the book, and I know you have plans for a mini series. But before we do that, what's your family history, your roots, and where did you grow up?
I'm originally from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Lots of my ancestors settled in Pittsburgh when they came here. My grandfather on my mother's side, Giuseppe Fusca, came from Calabria and settled in the Pittsburgh area, as did many of, or all of his brothers and sisters. I think there were like nine in total who came in the late 1800s. I grew up there in a very large, active, loving Italian family, typical Italian family that spent a lot of time around the dining room table and a lot of time telling stories about the old country. And actually, if truth be known, that was me sitting at the feet of my grandparents and great aunts and uncles in preparation. I didn't know it at the time, but in preparation for writing this book. We eventually moved to my family eventually moved to Southern New Jersey the same year I went away to college. I went to Villanova, and at Villanova I studied at double major, English and theater, and I stepped up my writing in earnest. I wrote ever since I was young, but I stepped up my writing in earnest at Villanova, and ended up following that doing a lot of theater, some television, some film. And it's funny, if I could sum the reason for all of this up into one word, it would be passion. I grew up in a family of passionate people. And, in the mid-50s, early 60s, we spent a lot of time, as I said, around the dining room table. And I remember in particular, my grandfather, this Giuseppe Fusca, we would cram ourselves into his dining room, eat and drink for hours. And inevitably, the mandolin came out, and there would be singing and laughter. And as I watched my grandfather's face, it would turn redder and redder. Now, admittedly, some of that might have been the whiskey, but his eyes would well up, and he would sing, and the tears would start flowing. Passion.
Yeah, I know exactly what you mean, because that's why I do it. I mean, I discovered my passion later. I mean, I was researching my family for about 5 years before I retired. But then since I retired, I mean, this is what I do, try to interview people, authors like you, but just regular people with their stories, because they're all so interesting to me. So now your family went to Pittsburgh. They came before the turn of the century then. They came pretty early.
Oh, yeah. My grandfather emigrated in 1898. All of his brothers and sisters came right around the same time, some a little bit later. Our family, like I said, is from Calabria, and our name is Fusca, F-U-S-C-A. And there's an accent over the C, so that it's Fusca. When he came in, they wrote it right in Ellis Island. But his other brothers and sisters, when they came over, they thought that was an F-U-S-I-A, that the C with the accent was an I. So most of my family call themselves fuchsia. Mm. And my brother and sister and I call ourselves from the Fusca family. And every couple of years, we have a family reunion somewhere in the country. And there's a battle between the Fusca name and the fuchsia name.
And so that's not typical for Calabria to have that accent over the sea. So were they originally French or something?
You know, I don't know that. I don't know that.
Because there's also a lot of people a Fusco, Fusco,
right?
And then it's also Fasco. I mean, I've heard all different things. So that's quite interesting. So now, do you know what industry brought them here? Were they doing something in Italy that they did when they came to America?
It was the industry of poverty. as much of southern Italy endured. The peninsula of Italy was broken up into many city-states in the 1800s. But beginning in 1815 and going to 1871, they created a one kingdom of Italy and Sicily. There was unification, and with Rome as the capital. And there were some civil wars, and the Mezzogiorno, which is the area south of Rome, among which is Calabria, they tried Piedmontization, they called it. They wanted to northernize, and they redistrict lands and took some land away, and poverty ran rampant, particularly in Calabria, where, you know, they would live in tufa, limestone huts that were built into the side of mountains. And they had a walkout basement. And that basement also served as a stable for the livestock. They lived above the livestock. Think about that. They had a one-room house. It had a fireplace that ran spring, summer, fall, and winter. In the winter and fall, it was for heat. In the spring and summer, it was so the smoke would keep the mosquitoes away. And they would have a piece of meat about this big, maybe, every 6 weeks. And they made do with a lot of vegetables. And it's funny because the stories I told you that, you know, my family used to sit around the table and tell stories about the old country, but they never talked about this. They never talked about the poverty. They never talked about why they came over. Later in life, when I had the fortune to be hired as a writer and associate producer for a documentary called Prisoners Among Us, where I started to really research my ancestry, all of our ancestry, and started to learn the truth of the Exodus, why 4.1 million Italians left Italy, and what they endured, so that you and I can sit here right now. It was eye-opening for me. While I thought I knew the history of my ancestors, I had no idea. And it's really the reason I wrote the book. Before the book was the documentary, which is Prisoners Among Us. It's about Italian-American immigration, assimilation, and the largely unknown events leading up to World War II. You can watch it free on Amazon. Directed by my good friend, Michael DeLauro. Michael DeLauro is a brilliant documentarian. And I was introduced to him by my brother, Chris, who owns a recording studio, and he does a lot of radio, TV, and film soundtracks, and he produces people's albums, and he's a composer and an arranger. He introduced me to Michael. He had worked with Michael. In fact, they both won Emmys. That's when I began to understand what my ancestors actually endured. And I know I get on my soapbox, but it's really important for us, for all of us, to understand our history. We need to understand our history. We owe that to our ancestors.
We'll be right back.
Italian Roots and Genealogy is proudly sponsored by Your Dolce Vita and Dawn Matera, connecting people to their purpose in life and continuing their legacy. For more information, contact Dawn at www.yourdolcevita.com.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, funny you mentioned the caves, because we were in Matera a couple of weeks ago and visited, you know, a cave dwelling there. And it just blew us away that the people, you know, the way you described it, they were living like that in 1958.
Oh, yeah.
1958. Oh, yeah. it's just so, so incredible to think that people were living, like you said, with the animals, with one room for the animals and one room for the people. And, you know, thankfully, the Italian president at the time moved them all out. And now, you know, now Matera is becoming a place for rich people more than it is for poor people.
Well, it's kind of funny because I have some friends who just got back from a trip to Calabria, going to the beaches and the villages and the mountains. And I saw some pictures on Facebook, and it was spectacular. You know,
oh, it's so incredible. It's so incredible. I mean, I had no idea when we made our trip last year. My grandmother's father's family, they were nobility. They own land in Calabria, I mean, and Naples and places. But we went to two towns in the mountains there, and it's just spectacular. And the people there are so much different than us. I mean, they're in these small towns. They're very happy. They enjoy life. They enjoy food. The food is fresh. Nothing comes in a package in those places. Now, right. Have you been to Calabria? I'm assuming that you probably have.
Yes. As a matter of fact, when I was in my freshman, sophomore, and junior years in high school, we rode horses to school back in those days, and it was a long time ago, put it that way. But freshman and sophomore years, we lived in London. My father worked for a management consulting firm and took advantage of the offices in Europe. So we lived in London for a couple of years. But junior year in high school, we moved to Milano in Italy for that year. And while we were in Italy, we did a lot of traveling, including Calabria. But back in those days, everybody in the towns we went to were related to us, you know. And I can remember going into one town, and we were driving a Ford Fairlane, you know, which was an oddity. And the whole town, it seemed, was like coming behind the car. And we would go to the largest garage next to a house in the town where they put out tables. And we must have had 50 people there eating and singing. And it was the electric was turned off at 5 o'clock in the afternoon. And they went to the well for water, but they were the happiest people in the world, at least back in, that was 1966, 67.
But you know, they still are. When we went there, they put out a spread. We went to two towns. We went to Fossato and Montebello, and Fossato, they set up this whole picnic with, you know, tables. And like I said, everything was made there, from the olive oil to the cheese, yeah, to the capicola. I mean, everything was made by them. The wine, of course. And it was just super. And like you said, they spent the whole day with us singing and dancing and showing us games that they played 300 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
We were on the land that, you know, was once owned by my family. It's now owned by somebody else. It's a big palazzo, and the current owner won't sell it. And they wanted to buy it. But I said to them, I said, doesn't the owner mind that we're doing this on his land? And they were like, he may come out after a while. And he did. And then he actually asked if we wanted to go inside. And then I said, of course I want to go inside. But it was sad in a way, because that place is, you know, just like a lot of places in Calabria and some of these small towns, nobody lives there. It's in disrepair. You could see what it once was. And then when we went into the town, the whole street was empty. But there was still furniture and stuff in the houses. So, you know, it was sad in a way. You know, it was right. Great, but it was also sad. I must have been I know going into these towns now was an adventure. It must have been something else going back 40 years, 50 years.
It was, you know, my parents were visionaries of sort to take their kids.
Yes.
To Europe for that extended period of time. Interestingly enough, after our year in Milano, was 1967, we were scheduled to go to Tel Aviv.
Oh, wow.
For my senior year.
Wow.
But that was the breakout of the war.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
We had an apartment rented, we were to come back to the States for a little bit and then go start my senior year in high school in Tel Aviv.
We lived in England in the mid 90s for 2 years. We lived in Bournemouth. That was, you know, a great experience. I mean, my son was a baby and my daughter wasn't born yet, but it was such a great experience because you don't know, and it must have been great being in Milan because you don't know what it's like living someplace else. Visiting is one thing, you're a tourist, but when you live there, you're not a tourist anymore.
No. You're
a resident. You know,
totally different. You know, when we were in England, I don't know, we want to talk about Italy, we want to talk about the book and stuff, but when we lived in England, in the first apartment that we had, it was a little upstairs flat, the electric ran on a meter that you would put shillings
yes,
in.
Yes, I heard that, yes.
Okay.
I heard that.
And we'd have a little bowl with a bunch of shillings in it, next to where the meter was, and you'd feed it, you know. But if you forgot, it'd be sitting there watching television or whatever you're doing. You hear a click, and everything goes out. So you scramble around and put the shillings in. And we had what they call paraffin. It was kerosene paraffin heaters in each room for heat in the winter. You know. So yes, you appreciate, or should appreciate, all the abundance, even in lower situations that we have in this country.
Yeah, and it's fun. We didn't have that, but you know, we did have to get the TV license, and I remember them asking me, "Do you want a color TV license or black and white?" Because the price was different, and they would drive around in trucks.
Yeah.
So you mentioned the book. Let's talk about the book. One of the things that I found interesting about it is it's set in the year that both my grandparents came over. My paternal grandfather came probably a little bit before my grandmother. But she came in 1915 and my mom's family came in 1915. And my mom's family came mainly because my grandfather had served in the Italian army during the Libyan War.
Yep.
And my grandmother said, "You're not going in the, you know, go fighting again." So they came over, and I think they intended to go back because they left my uncle there, but they never did. So that's what I found really interesting. And the book is about basically three families from three different parts of Italy that went to three different parts of America, right?
Right. The book is a book of historical fiction. The three families are composites of my family, people in the documentary, other reading and researching I did. I'm a fanatic about historical accuracy. And the book actually took 12 years to write. The reason being, without exaggeration, 10 of those years were research. While the characters are fiction, the events, the descriptions, everything in the book is absolutely verified and historically accurate to the point that you mentioned 1915. Yes, all three of these families who don't know each other, one from, is a stowaway teenager from Calabria, from Palermo, a family from Calabria and a family from Naples, end up on the same steamship traveling to the United States in 1915. They travel in steerage, which is the belly of the beast. It's down next to the engine compartment because they couldn't afford anything else. This again, my family never told me. There were rapes, there were murders, deathly sick for 13 days of brutal passage. It was an awful ordeal. And then once they got here, the streets weren't paved with gold. Once they got here, they had to actually dig the streets. They had to actually shovel out the sewers. Some of them in New York became rag and bone men. You ever hear of a rag and bone man?
I know about the rag man, but I didn't know I don't know about the bone part.
A rag and bone man, what they did was they had these big carts that they would pull around the city streets starting at 5 o'clock in the morning. And they have wicker baskets on their backs and the sticks like the guys along the highway have. And they would pick up anything, rags, they would pick up metal, broken bottles, and dead animals. Mm-hmm. And they would, at the end of the day, dump them down into a basement, and the people would sort them out to see what they could repurpose. And usually, a person got paid 5 cents for the day. By the way, the reason they were dead animals is because they would use the bones to make knife handles.
Oh, wow. But
those were the kinds of things our ancestors endured. And so one family settles in New York City, and he's a tailor. One family settles in Cleveland, and he's a construction guy, so he starts out as a stone cutter in Cleveland. And the stowaway eventually hooks up with his uncle in Monterey, California, who is a sardine fisherman. By the way, I know more about sardine fishing in 1920 than any man needs to know. Speaking of research, the interesting thing about the book is that, as you said, they're from three different parts of Italy, and they settle in three different parts of America. And I think that's important because they have different vocations, they explore their assimilation in this country from different perspectives. And this is actually book one. It goes from 1915 to 1927 when it ends with the execution of Sacco and Vanzetti, which was a seminal moment in Italian-American history, which is why I ended it there. I'm working on book two, I'm about 17 chapters in, and that takes these families and their descendants to 1946, 47, whenever year the All-Star Game was in Wrigley Field, and there's a reason for that. But like I say, I'm like 16, 17 chapters in. I keep promising book two, but the development of a possibility of this becoming a television miniseries has gotten in the way. But the thing that is important to me, like I said, is that our children and our grandchildren understand their history, understand where they came from. I don't want to get political, but we do not study history. It is really a sad void these days. And so, you know, I want to try and get this book into the hands of many, many Italian Americans so that they can see what their ancestors endured, so they can they can honor them for the sacrifices they made. Like I said, so that Bob and Joe can sit here, you know? By the way, you can get the book on Amazon.
We'll put the links out there, yeah.
Okay, it's L'America. And the reason it's called L'America is because that's what the Italians used to say. They were going to L'America.
Mm-hmm.
I'm pretty proud of it, as I am proud of the documentary. The documentary goes into great detail about immigration and assimilation. And I said largely unknown events leading up to World War II. And those events are when Italy sided with the Axis powers at the start of the war, things changed for the Italian in America.
Yes.
Significantly. First of all, Italians were conflicted. They loved their new country, and they loved their old country. And some of them thought that Mussolini was the best thing since sliced bread. You know, the old saying, you made the trains run on time. Others considered him a fat clown. And so there was a lot of conflict. But the government was concerned that there might be a fifth column in this country of Italians, Germans, Japanese, who were working undercover to overthrow the government. And so 600,000 Italians who did not get their American citizenship were labeled enemy aliens. There was a proclamation.
My grandparents.
Yeah.
I still have the cards with their photos on it.
Yeah. There was a proclamation issued by Roosevelt, and they had to be fingerprinted. Mm-hmm. They had travel restrictions. They had curfews. And some of their houses, if they suspected they were fascist sympathizers, just because they had a picture of Mussolini on their dining room wall, or because they retained their fascist card, some of them, they would break into their homes. The FBI would come unannounced and take their flashlights, their radios, and their cameras for fear that, you know, they would use these tools to undermine the government. In worst case scenarios, some were interned. There were many internment camps around the country. One of them, ironically, was Ellis Island. So picture this, you have the Italian who comes to America for a renaissance through the Great Hall in Ellis Island, And then years later, he's on a cot in Ellis Island as a prisoner.
I didn't know that. I didn't realize that, that they used Ellis Island. Wow. Yes. You know, my grandpa, my mom's parents, they had, by the end of the war, they had four sons in the service. But they, you know, they were, at the beginning, they were branded enemy aliens.
Yeah. So that happened. Another thing that happened at the start of World War II is they decided, you know what? These Italians may signal subs off the coast of California. And so they set up lines of demarcation that were outside the urban areas of California. They would draw a line. And if you were an Italian without American citizenship and you lived west of that line, you were relocated. And when I say relocated, I use that term loosely. You were told to relocate. Go across that line, east of that line, board up your house. How you live is up to you. And if you have any reason to cross that line for a doctor's appointment or whatever, you had to call the police station and you'd have to be accompanied by an officer to be able to cross that line, do your business, and then go back across. The fishermen in California who own fishing boats, and this is in the book, as I said, they have the guy from the stowaway from Palermo ends up in the fishing business, but they confiscated their boats and retrofitted them so that they could patrol the waters off the coast of California. And so these people were left without without a means to make a living. They were given a little stipend, but it was nothing. Here's an interesting and important point. When I was writing the documentary, and I was excited about it, I was talking to my aunt, my mother's mother. My mother had died when she was in her early 60s, and my aunt, her sister, became my mother. So I couldn't wait to tell my Aunt Tina about the documentary, Prisoners Among Us. And so I was telling her about all this stuff and telling her about internment and relocation and the boats and everything. And she was stone-faced. She just looked at me. And I thought, what's going on? And then she pointed to me and she said, Italians aren't complainers. Don't make a movie about complainers. Right. That stuck with me. And I went back and rewrote so that the documentary and ultimately the book and the miniseries are stories of victory. Not, oh, woe is me. Not, we need reparations. Not, look what happened to us. Because if truth be known, what happened to us happened to everybody.
Yeah.
You're Native American. Your ancestors came from somewhere. They endured the same mistreatment in different situations, different experiences, but they endured a lot. As a matter of fact, the poster for the miniseries, the tagline is, it's not just their story, it's your story too. This is really, I remember when we screened the documentary at the New York Independent Film Festival, which it won, by the way. We had a booth and people would come up and talk to us after the screening. And there was an Asian couple who came up to me when I was in the booth and they said, look, I know you're Italian and I know this is about Italians, but this is about us too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And yeah,
it's true. It's absolutely true. But it's amazing. Speaking of Italians and our ancestors, of what, as I said, they endured and never spoke about it. When we were doing the documentary, and we had, I don't know, maybe 200 hours of interviews in the can, when we were doing that documentary, we were using crowbars to pry these stories out of the Italians. Very proud people, very proud people.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's not important. Yeah, okay, we were relocated, but it was only a short period of time. We rolled up our sleeves and went back to work.
Well, yeah, and that's why it's so important to hear these things. You know, I know my friend Anthony, you know, in the 70s, Anthony Riccio, and he had the wherewithal to interview people that had come in the early 1900s. They were in their 70s and get their stories about Italy, what it was like growing up. And you know, that's my biggest fear, is that, you know, we lose all of this. For example, I had no idea about Ellis Island myself, you know, and I've been around for a long time. But, you know, the younger people are, they're not exposed to that. Like we were talking earlier, what they see on, they see the Sopranos and Goodfellas, and they think that's our history. Right. And it's not. You know, I, on the way back from the trip a couple of weeks ago, I watched the documentary that Billy Crystal did on Yogi Berra. Fascinating.
Yeah. Yeah.
It was I was glued to this because I grew up with Yogi Berra, right? And I actually got his autograph, oh, probably, I don't know, 2010 or something. It was after he made up with Steinbrenner. And it was like meeting the Pope.
Sure.
I walked up to him with a baseball, you know, Mr. Berra could sign it. I mean, literally, that's the feeling I had. Yeah. I was meeting a god because growing up, Yogi Berra, Mickey Mouse, you know, but because he was Italian, of course, he was special, you know.
Right. Well, little inside information about the book two. And I mentioned that it ends in 40, I think it's 47, which is when the All-Star game was in Wrigley Field. Well, Joe DiMaggio's parents were sardine fishermen in Monterey. They're in the book. And Joe, as a young boy, hated sardine fishing. He got nauseous at the smell of fish. And he always ran off to play sandlot ball. But he befriends Paolo, who is the guy who becomes a sardine fisherman from Palermo, because the DiMaggios were from Sicily as well.
Yeah.
He befriends him. And the Wrigley Field All-Star game enters into the end of the book.
That's interesting. And you know, they went into that relationship with Berra and DiMaggio because DiMaggio was, you know, a handsome, you know, tall for Italian type of guy, and it was, you know, one of the sad things about Yogi was, and I didn't realize this growing up, but they made him a clown, which was, and even later on, it was very, very sad when I saw that. I was really bummed about that when I was watching this thing.
And he was a major talent.
Oh, super. I remember growing up, you know, I must have been, you know, 7, 8, 9 or whatever, and he would hit a ball that was at his ankles, you know, double, you know, down the right field line or something like that. He could hit, and they talk about it, he could hit anything. He could
hit anything. You know,
and not strike out. He never struck out.
I mentioned did I mention, or maybe this is when we were talking before we started. There are certain elements you have to satisfy to get to, and we'll talk about the miniseries, but the pilot is written for the miniseries and worked with a guy by the name of AJ Ferrara, who wrote the pilot. And AJ wrote a screenplay about Joe Pepitone, which is really interesting. There are many prominent Italians in the world of baseball, you know.
Yeah, and Pepitone was a wild and crazy guy.
Well, that's obviously one of the reasons for writing the film. He was he liked to party, you know.
Well, yeah, and I forget which book it was about the Yankees where he Actually, with two stories I remember telling about Mickey Mantle. The first one was he was a rookie, and they were out partying one night, and they were supposed to play an exhibition game at West Point, and they woke up late. You know, they were out all night. They woke up late, and Mantle told them, "Don't worry about it. I'll, you know, get a car." And he gets this limousine, and he tells the driver, "Pick up 2 quarts of vodka and 2 quarts of orange juice," and he drives right up on a field. with Pepitone. And then there was another story where Pepitone got him high on marijuana. He gave Mickey before the game.
Sure.
And he said, normally when Mickey would strike out, he'd throw the helmet, he'd throw the bat, he'd throw things. And he says, he struck out on 3 pitches, 1, 2, 3. He said he took off the helmet, put it down. It's nice. Put the bat down. And he said he came over to me on the bench and said, "If you ever give me that again, I'll kill you."
That's funny.
But like you said, there was so many. But I always remember Yogi as that guy, clutch hits. One thing that they said in the documentary was. It was Jeter who was talking to him, and Jeter said something to him about, it's a lot harder now to get, playing 10 World Series, there's more teams and there's playoffs and this like that. And he said, Yogi said to me, "That's fine. Tell me when you get 10 rings."
Yeah, we'll talk. That's fun.
And he was, he was just a fascinating, fascinating figure that we grew up with. So now you mentioned it's you hope to turn this into a documentary, which will be
a miniseries.
Yeah, a miniseries. Yeah,
yes.
Be super.
Yeah, I don't even know how they found me, but and look, you write a book and it gets some notoriety, some good reviews, and that kind of thing, and so people start emailing you, people start calling you, they're going to get your book in 1,000 bookstores, and they're going to do this for you and that for you, and a lot of it is unnecessary. But this company called Little Studio Films in Beverly Hills contacted me, said read your book, and we'd really like to talk. And it's actually the company that's owned by an Italian woman. And she contacted me, she emailed me, and I thought, that's another scam. But something told me, let me get back to her. So I did get back to her, and we started talking, and I researched her. And Little Studio Films is a legitimate player and does a lot of global film. And So I signed a contract with them to develop L'America into a television miniseries, which, yes, on a number of levels is very exciting. First of all, everybody else's story has been told, but the true story of Italian immigration and assimilation has not really been told. We are not just mafia. We don't just own pizza joints and off people. That's not who we are. We have returned volumes of heritage and culture and artistry and on and on to the landscape we call America. And that story has to be told. Our children and grandchildren have to hear that story. And this is a way of doing that, obviously. So I'm excited about that. I get on a soapbox, when I talk about my heritage, and I get my back up a little bit when people want to turn it to mafia. And look, the truth is, the mafia existed and exists. And there were different forms of mafia. In fact, in my book, the Camorra, which is the mafia in Naples, are the reason why the family from Naples, leaves Naples and goes to goes to Cleveland, and the mafia, the Cosa Nostra in Palermo is the reason why Paolo in Palermo stows away and goes to New York. And in fact, when he first goes to New York, he's interested in the Black Hand. He thinks he's going to get in the Black Hand, but that doesn't work. And he ends up with his uncle in California. But I'm actually going out to L.A. again the end of this month for a series of meetings to try and get a deal done. It moves slow, and there's certain elements that you have to satisfy in order to get to a seat at the table with the big boys. We've done that, and so we'll see what happens.
Yeah, and you know, like you said, there's so little real stuff written about that, and also, you know, the history of Italy too. Like we were talking earlier, you know, they've made tons and tons of movies about Spain and France and England, which is all fine, but nothing about Italy between 1861 and Rome. Yeah. Very little. I mean, there's tons of stuff about Rome, but you know, people don't know about the French being there, the Spanish being there, the Austrians being there, and how Italy became, the culture of Italy became Italian. Mm-hmm. It's just nothing about it. I mean, look at Sicily, how many times it was invaded and, you know, taken over by people. And, you know, I always laugh when people say I'm 100% Italian and my DNA says I'm this, that, and the other thing. Well, yeah, of course, because everybody had a piece of Italy at some point in time, but it's not told. We don't know about it.
By the way, I will never have my DNA checked. I'm 100% Italian from my head down to my feet. I know that. I don't want somebody telling me I got 2% something else.
Yeah. Well, you know, I say to people, I say, well, you know, there's DNA and then there's culture and heritage. I said, and it's two completely different things. I mean, your culture is your culture and your heritage. Of course, it's Italian. That's where your family's from.
Right.
You know, one very interesting thing about my mother's family from, now they were both from Torito and Bari. And my mother's, my mother line is like 97% from the Caucasus. Just, I found that so incredibly amazing. Mm-hmm. And the only thing and some of that shows up in France. And I remember my mother telling me that my grandmother, her mother, used to say that the family was originally from France. But, you know, who knows? I mean, you know, who knows when, how, why they got there.
Yeah.
But, you know, they came from this little small town in Puglia, which I had the best piece of sausage I ever ate there a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah, it actually, everything tastes better in
Italy. That's right.
It just could be the same recipe, the same food as in New York City, but it tastes better in Italy. And actually, I'm going to, I'll share a little, you know, I told you early on, passion. Well, I know I'm 100% Italian because I cry equally hard when I land there and when I take off to go.
Yeah, I know. I was interviewed while I was there by, I think Letizia, I think they're trying to, you know, gear up tourism and everything. And I don't speak Italian. I wish I did. I mean, my vocabulary is, you know, like a 2-year-old. But they asked me a question. They said, when you're in Italy, how do you feel? Do you feel Italian? And I said, well, yes and no. And so they said, well, what do you mean? I said, well, I feel Italian while I'm here and walking the streets and everything. I said, but when somebody asks me a question in Italian and I can't answer, yeah, I said, I feel like an American.
Yeah, well, you know, it is... I do envy. Now, I used to speak Italian much better when we lived there, you know.
Sure, yeah.
We had to. And I wish I spoke to that level today. But I, if I'm going to Italy, I want to, you know, I want to bone up a little bit so that I can hold my own.
You kind of sort of catch on. I mean, there's so many words that are similar. And when I was talking to somebody over there, they said the toughest thing about Italian for Americans, or I guess anybody who speaks English, is conjugating the verbs. And they said, don't worry about that so much. You know, we have problems with your language because you have so many things that are spelled differently that mean the same thing, and right. You know, vice versa. But they said, if you say you mangia and you don't use the right verb tense, understand.
They still, and the other thing is there's so many dialects.
Oh yes,
my mother's family's from Calabria. Calabrese is like nowhere near real Italian.
I asked them, last year. I asked them. They sang a song, and I wanted to learn to play it. I said, "Could you send me the words?" You know, and they sent it to me, and I was like, "Oh my God, this is an Italian." Mm-hmm. But then, just you know, when we were there a couple of weeks ago, and we're in Puglia, and the driver, you know, we were talking about Barese and Italian, and he would say something in Italian and then say it in Barese, and it was like, whew, not even close. I mean, you wouldn't know that's what he was talking about.
It's at the start, you know, because you read it, but at the start of each chapter in the book, I have a quote from some source. And one of the chapters is about when the people from steerage on the steamship were, they had a lot of bad weather, and they were finally able to get up on deck. When the sun came out, they get up on deck and they break out their bread and whatever biscuits or things that they had brought for the trip, and they break out the instruments and start playing. And there is a Calabrian folk song that they sing on the deck of the ship. And so part of the quote at the beginning of that chapter is like four lines, a verse or something from, it's called The Calabrian Maiden. And I had an Italian read the book and she came back to me and said, you know, I'm sorry that you published this, but that's not real Italian in the book. You've misspelled words and, you know, I don't even know what this is. You need to make this book accurate. You know, and I'm trying to tell her it's more accurate than you think.
Yeah.
You know, this is when the Calabrese are up on the deck singing a song, they're singing their dialect, you know?
Yep. Yeah. Yeah. And like I said, it was like, you know, when they were singing, and because, you know, my brain, when I'm in Italy, said this may be Italian, it sounded Italian to me. But when they sent me the words, I was like, whoo, this is something else completely. And, you know, and the driver told us, he said, when he was growing up, I guess in his late 50s, early 60s, something like that. He said when he was growing up, they weren't allowed to speak the dialect in school. They had to speak Italian. But he said now it's starting to come back. This is starting to bring it back and, you know, teach, you know, kids, and people want to understand it and things like that. So before we go, I know you mentioned it before, but where can people find the book?
You can find the book on Amazon. It's L'America, L'America. Now you'll find another L'America. I forget what it is. And I think there's a Doors song called L'America, but it's on Amazon. It's also on Barnes & Noble's website, but most people go to Amazon. I would love any Italians or anyone listening or watching this podcast to go grab a copy, because it's important history. It truly is. And I'm not saying that in any boastful way, but it's important for you to learn what's in there. And it's it's a situation. Oh, and by the way, if you do that and you do it on Amazon, I would love to see a review.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, it's certainly important to give it to the, you know, the fourth and fifth and sixth generation Italian Americans, because they you know, they don't know. I mean, we know because we lived with the grandparents. We heard the language. We heard the stories. But, you know, they think that they don't realize the hardships that, that our ancestors went through.
And I didn't. I called myself a proud Italian American, but I didn't. I didn't know this stuff. You know, I didn't know about steerage. You know, I didn't know about the what they call the buttonhook men on Ellis Island who turned their eyelids inside out looking for trachoma. I didn't know about a psychopathic pavilion that they built. A four-story psychopathic pavilion was built on Ellis Island because when you came onto the island, if they saw any sign of dementia, you were interned in that building until you were deemed fit to get on the city streets.
Well, yeah, they actually, you know, because I watched that documentary about Ellis Island, they actually had pictures of people with you know, like moron, idiot, you know, next to that. And very disconcerting when you see that kind of stuff.
And I mean, try that today. You know, they would give these poor old people a 5-piece wooden puzzle that was supposed to be a man's head. And they had a certain amount of time when they came into Ellis Island, they had a certain amount of time to try and make this head, you know, right. And if they didn't, they were deemed moron.
Yeah, I know. Incredible.
There's an episode in the miniseries that deals with that Ellis Island experience.
Well, you know, we need to get all the Italian Americans to start pressuring them to actually do this miniseries. However we can get the word out, we do that.
Okay. I keep telling them, you know, I'm getting older and older and older, you know, the fast forward on my remote is pushed the entire time in my life now. So I don't have much time. Let's get this done.
I know what you mean. I know exactly what you're talking about. Well, listen, Joe, this has been great fun. I really appreciate you taking the time. And for people listening, make sure you go out and get this book. It's a great book.
I really appreciate it, Bob. Thanks so much for having me.
You're welcome.